Conference record has joined the conference.
Hi, everybody. This is Kyla Patterson. I'm a technical assistance consultant in the Infant and Toddler Connection of Virginia State Office. Welcome to our webinar today on understanding the Part C eligibility determination, assessment, and transition requirements. This is a session that I did, it's a repeat of a session that I did this summer at the Creating Connections to Shining Stars conference in Virginia Beach. And I know that's a conference that not everybody can get to. And a number of the local system managers and service providers who attended that session thought that, you know, it was important and a lot of other people would like to hear the information. And that's why we've set up a regional webinar in each area of the state. And we decided to do it regionally instead of statewide just because it would allow us to have a live question and answer session instead of trying to do that through the chat. And we'll talk a little bit later about exactly how we're going to make that live question and answer work. But just so you know up front, there we'll sort of stop partway through the material and do some question and answers, and then we'll have some more at the end. The purpose of today's session is to hopefully help folks feel more confident in taking what they know about the requirements for eligibility, assessment, transition, and being able to apply those in a wide variety of situations and scenarios. And so, you know, I think we've all had that experience where we read a document or attend a training or listen to a webinar and leave feeling like, oh, yeah, I've got that. I understand. And then maybe we get into the actual situation and are no longer so sure we understood, or maybe it's a situation that's not typical, not something we've run across before. And although we sort of understood the main rules, now we're not sure how to apply those in this other kind of a situation. So today we're going to review the requirements, focusing mostly on those where we're still hearing some questions and confusion, and then use some scenarios to kind of walk through applying those requirements in several different situations. And so hopefully that will help folks feel a bit more confident. I'm going to divide the session into two parts. So we'll start by talking about eligibility assessment and IFSP, and then, like I said, we'll have a chance for some question and answers. And then the second part will be about transition, and we'll have time for additional questions after that part. So if we start with eligibility determination, as the child's coming in, and we're going to first talk about that initial set of requirements with eligibility assessment and IFSP, and then we'll tackle the annual kind of issues. So the child's coming in, and one thing I want folks to really think about is that the very first question that you're asking yourself when you think about eligibility for every single child is, can eligibility be established by records? And when I say records, I mean records that exist already, so medical records, records of a prior evaluation or assessment, those kinds of things. And we know that if there is a documented diagnosed condition, then the service coordinator can immediately complete the eligibility determination form, and nobody else needs to be involved. There are no other steps in that process of eligibility. If the records document a delay or atypical development, then one early intervention professional can complete the eligibility determination form. And again, there's no need to involve other people or other steps. So if the answer to the question, can eligibility be established by records, is yes, then you're moving straight on to assessment for service planning. It's only if the answer is no, you cannot establish eligibility by records, that you really move to the full eligibility determination process. And it's at that point that you're going to be gathering that broader array of information, that you would be using an instrument to gather information in all areas of development, conducting some observation, gathering history, parent report, and gathering any medical and other records that might be available. You know, usually that's the service coordinator doing that. It might be an early intervention professional. But that information is gathered, and then a multidisciplinary team reviews that information in order to determine eligibility. And I think one of the areas where we still get a fair number of questions is who needs to be involved in each of these steps of the process. So in terms of eligibility determination, that multidisciplinary team needs to include the service coordinator plus two disciplines. Okay? And so that could look like this, kind of a fairly traditional or basic model of that three people, a service coordinator, maybe it's an educator, and a speech-language pathologist. But it could also look like this. If that service coordinator is duly qualified as an early intervention professional, then that person can wear both of those hats, and then you have the speech-language pathologist. So you still have your service coordinator and two disciplines. We also know that if one person is duly qualified as an early intervention professional in two different areas, so if they're an early childhood special educator and a speech-language pathologist, then they can wear both of those hats, and we still have our service coordinator plus two disciplines involved in that multidisciplinary team. There also may be a situation where you have an outside report, maybe from a physical therapist. And so that also counts as one of the disciplines involved in the multidisciplinary team for eligibility determination. And again, remember that that internal person could be duly qualified as a service coordinator and an early intervention professional. So there are a lot of different ways that that can look, that you can get that service coordinator plus two disciplines that are required. One of the handouts that I sent ahead of time was a flow chart that kind of, is designed, something you can take back with you that kind of has a reminder of how each of these steps works and who needs to be involved. So this is the top of that chart with the reminder again that initial eligibility might be established by records because there's a diagnosed condition, might be established by records because of a delay or atypical, and if neither of those work, then you're going to have your service coordinator plus your two disciplines involved. And then whichever one of those boxes establishes your eligibility, you're moving on then, of course, to the assessment for service planning. When we get to the assessment for service planning, the purpose of our work changes, right? Now we're focused on identifying the child's strengths and needs in all areas of development and their functional status in the three child indicator areas. And we're doing that by reviewing available pertinent records, using a tool as an age anchor, and conducting personal observation of the child, right? We also know that family assessment is a part of that process as well. Again, the federal regulations require that we have a multidisciplinary team involved in that assessment for service planning. And again, that's a service coordinator plus two disciplines. So just like with eligibility determination, that can look a lot of different ways depending on the personnel that you have available in your system, whether there's an outside report, whether your service coordinators serve in dual roles, and so on. So we can look again. It could be the three people. It could be a duly qualified service coordinator plus another early intervention professional, or we might have that example where we've got one of the disciplines is from an outside report. Okay. And then we continue to move down the flow chart, and I'll just make a comment. I'll go back here for just a second, and the people with the hats is just designed as kind of a visual representation of how you can use the people in your local system and think about how they make up teams. I hope that's that's helpful. I know Bev Krause in the southwest part of the state has even used Lego people with local systems. So you may find it helpful to use something concrete and visual like that if you're still working to figure out the best way to have teams around these steps in the process. Okay, so the flowchart again just reminds us that we need a service coordinator plus two disciplines, and that that could be a service coordinator, an early intervention professional, and an outside report, and that a tool is required. And then we're moving on to the initial IFSP meeting. And now the regulations change their definition of a team. For the IFSP meeting, you have to have the parent, the service coordinator, and at least one more individual from a discipline other than service coordination. Okay? So would this setup work as an IFSP team? Why don't you weigh in the chat box and let me know, yes or no, would this work as your multidisciplinary team? Anybody weighing in on chat? Are you not able to find your chat box? You may have an orange arrow kind of on the side in the corner that has collapsed your little chat box area. If you click that orange arrow, it should open it back up again since you can see it. I see one person has weighed in with a no. We have a yes and a no. Thank you all for weighing in, and we have a yes. So we have kind of a mixed response, and this one is a little bit tricky. But in this case, although this would work, you know, to have the service coordinator wear the educator hat as well, would work fine at eligibility or assessment. This does not actually meet the requirements of a multidisciplinary team when you're at the IFSP. And that's because, again, it says you have to have a service coordinator, the parent, and at least one more individual from another discipline. So previously you could sort of count the hats to be sure you had the right people. Now you also have to pay attention to the bodies, the stick figure people, to make sure you have enough of those as well. So in this situation, the service coordinator, for purposes of counting your team members, only counts as the service coordinator. Certainly she's going to bring that expertise and experience she has as an educator to the table, but for purposes of having the right people, she only counts as the service coordinator, and we would need to add another individual from another discipline other than service coordination in order to have our complete IFSP team. Okay. So that sort of takes us through the initial process as children come into the system. The annual process is another point where I know that there has been confusion, and I'll stop for just a second because I do see a question in the chat asking if that person, for instance, that PT, I think in what we just looked at, has to be in person or can they participate in writing? And yes, that's a good reminder that these folks have to be invited to participate in the IFSP meeting, but if they are unable to participate in person, then you make other arrangements. They can participate by phone, by video conference, or in writing. All right, so let's talk about then what happens annually. And the process is very similar to what we do at the initial in terms of the steps that we need to think about. So with eligibility determination at the annual, we're going to start by asking the exact same question. Can eligibility be established by records? The difference here is what counts as records. So initially, you would only use records that they had coming into your system. Now you can use those records plus any records you've accumulated since they've been in your system. So contact notes count as records when you're asking yourself the question, can eligibility be established by records? So it's only if the answer to that question is no that you need to use a full eligibility determination process at the annual. If you do need to use that process, then the rules are the same as they are at initial, in that you need to have covered all areas of development and use a tool if needed to cover the remaining areas. And you do need to have a multidisciplinary team involved, a service coordinator plus two disciplines. With assessment for service planning, a couple of notes here. Number one, keep in mind that the purpose of the annual IFSP is to evaluate the IFSP, not the child. So you're looking to make sure you have enough information to know the strengths and needs in all areas, the status in the three indicators, so that you can evaluate the existing IFSP outcomes and supports and services and plan for any appropriate changes. Okay, so you're going to start by looking to see if you have enough information from ongoing assessment to talk about strengths, needs, their status in the three indicator areas, and to know whether or not you need to change outcomes or services. And it's only if you don't have enough that you're going to do any additional assessment, okay? But again, if you do need to hold an assessment at the annual, then it does need to follow the rules of an assessment and involve a multidisciplinary team. But let's think about that. So if the child is receiving speech-language pathology services, and so there's some ongoing assessment information in several areas of development, but maybe that speech-language pathologist is not so sure about the child's status with some motor issues, and so they might pull in that OT or the PT to do some assessment in those areas to make sure they have a complete picture. And so that speech-language pathologist who has that ongoing assessment information plus that, we'll say they pulled in a PT, plus the service coordinator makes up that assessment team. I see we have a question about how old can the records be. I assume that that's going back to the eligibility determination question. And the answer to that is, you know, we always talk about the records need to be no older than 6 months, and we need to know that they still represent the child's status. Actually, let me go back a second here. And then we have with the annual IFSP meeting, that part is exactly the same in terms of who the participants need to be at the annual. So again, it's the parent, the service coordinator, and one more individual from another discipline, just like it was at the initial. In addition to the, well, let me look at this part. This is the bottom of the flowchart that we've been looking at. And so, again, it breaks it down into the ways that you're going to establish eligibility at annual. Either it's established by records because of a diagnosed condition or a delay or atypical, or if it can't be established by records, you've got your service coordinator plus two disciplines who are looking at contact notes and stuff now, right, in addition to any other information they may have to gather. You move to the annual assessment for service planning, a reminder that this is generally not going to be a separate step. Hopefully you have that ongoing assessment information. And then if not, you're going to bring in the disciplines that are needed to make up that service coordinator plus two discipline requirement. And then moving on to the annual IFSP meeting. I also sent out ahead a flowchart that's specifically about preparing for the annual IFSP, because I do know this is still a point with some confusion of trying to figure out, okay, do I have the right information? Who else needs to look at it? Who needs to be involved? So this is an attempt to kind of summarize some of that information in a way that you could potentially use in general as reminders, but maybe even when looking at the situation with a particular child. So I'm not going to read these boxes to you, but basically at the top, you've either got a child who's receiving some ongoing services in addition to service coordination, or you've got a child who's receiving service coordination only or hasn't been seen for an extended period of time. Those are kind of your starting points. And at each step along the way, it's sort of having you assess whether you have enough information to complete that step or you don't have enough. And then given your answer to that question, who needs to be involved? What do you need to gather? Okay. And again, taking a look at this may also help you think about your practices, your procedures that you have in place leading up to an annual, so that you can minimize the number of times you're answering not enough, right? Because if you're planning ahead and thinking about it, then those intervention sessions that are leading up towards the annual, you may make some conscious decisions about what information you want to be sure you've got. Okay, so let's take a look now at some specific scenarios and how the information we just talked about kind of plays into those particular situations. So as you think about scenarios, as you're working with actual children and families, you're going to want to be paying attention to what information you've got available, because that kind of guides your next choices and what you need to do and who needs to be involved. And then obviously in your local system, the model of service coordination that you use, whether that's a blended model where they also wear an early intervention professional hat, is going to play into that decision about who's going to be involved. So in our first scenario, we have Bobby. And as he's coming into the system, we know that he is blind and was referred to the local system at 3 months of age by his pediatrician. The ophthalmologist has provided documentation of Bobby's visual disability. So if we remember our question, what is the first question we ask when we're thinking about eligibility determination? And I'm hoping somebody will type that into the chat for us. Right. Thank you, Jenny. Can eligibility be established by records? Yes. Thank you, Margaret. Exactly. And so in this case, the answer is yes. We have documentation from the ophthalmologist of his visual disability. So the service coordinator can review that, complete the eligibility determination form, and we're moving on to the assessment for service planning. We don't have any indication here that there's any kind of existing report that meets the purposes of assessment for service planning. So at that point, you're going to need the service coordinator plus two disciplines involved in the assessment. And then you'll move on to the IFSP, where you're going to have the family, the service coordinator, and then another person from a discipline other than service coordination will be involved in the IFSP. And I should have mentioned earlier, just a reminder, when you think about that IFSP team, not only do you need to remember parent, service coordinator, and another individual from another discipline other than service coordinator, you also need to remember that the federal regulations say that you need somebody, that the team members include people who were involved in the eligibility determination and or the assessment for service planning. So in Bobby's case, as he's coming in, you're saying to parent, the service coordinator, and then that other individual is going to be somebody who was involved in that assessment step. And then we come to Bobby's annual IFSP, and I'm going to give you just a minute to read through the information that we have available at the annual. Okay, So we know that at the annual we have to confirm or establish that the child is still eligible for early intervention services. And once again, we're going to ask ourselves the question, can eligibility be established by records? And yes, Bobby still has a diagnosed condition that makes him eligible. So nobody else needs to be involved in that step. There's nothing else to do other than the service coordinator completing that eligibility determination form. And then with the annual assessment for service planning, let's assume that the service providers have enough information from ongoing assessment during service delivery that they are able to complete the assessment section of the IFSP and they have enough information for determining whether the outcomes and the services are still appropriate. So assuming that that is the case, there's nothing else that needs to be done in terms of assessment for service planning. There's nobody else who needs to be involved. And then you move right to the annual IFSP, okay? Let's assume, it's not perfectly clear in the example, but let's assume Joan, the service coordinator, who's also certified in early childhood special education, is the person providing developmental services. So Joan's participation in the IFSP team meeting only counts as the service coordinator person, right? So we would have Joan and the parent, and then we would need another person. Hopefully that vision services person would be that third person participating, right? Okay. I see a question in the chat from Margaret who's asking, does a service coordinator have to be physically present at an assessment? And of course, the service coordinator's role at the assessment is partly gathering some of that family assessment information, which may not be happening at that moment, but also to be a support to the family, to be a participant in that assessment process. That does not mean that service coordinator always has to be present. You'd have to work that out in the particular situation with that family, but we know that an assessment doesn't have to be everybody sitting in one place at one time. Our second scenario involves Katie. She is 16 months old and was referred by her child care provider because of concerns about language development. The child care provider reports Katie does not talk as much as the other kids her age. Katie's mom tells the service coordinator that the pediatrician did a language test at her 9-month checkup and that there were no concerns at that time. The service coordinator is able to get a copy of the developmental screening that was done at Katie's 9-month well child visit, and it does show that there are no delays or were no delays at that time. Okay, so at the initial eligibility determination, we're asking ourselves, can eligibility be established by records? And using chat, why don't you weigh in with your answer to that question? Do you think eligibility can be established by records in this situation? A couple of people weighing in with no. Anybody else? Anybody have a different opinion? There were no concerns. No, it's older than 6 months old. No. Yeah, you all are exactly right. The answer is no, and there are a couple of reasons, and various folks have pointed those out. One is the records that you have are more than 6 months old. And the second is, even if those records were less than 6 months old, the regulations say that you can establish eligibility by records. It doesn't say that you can establish a child's ineligibility by records, and that's an important distinction to make as well. So very good. Everybody was right on top of that one. Okay, so if we then move on to the assessment for service planning for Katie, again, we don't appear to have any records that would sort of speak to assessment for service planning, so we'll need to have a service coordinator and two disciplines involved. And then at the IFSP, the service coordinator, the family, and someone, another individual, who was involved in either that eligibility determination or assessment for service planning process. Okay, and then at the annual, Katie is, she's been receiving service coordination as well as speech-language pathology services twice a month. One visit each month is at home with Katie and her mom, and the other's at daycare with Katie and her child care provider. Based on ongoing assessment, the speech-language pathologist knows Katie's language skills are at the 18 to 20-month age level and that language delays are impacting Katie's social interactions with the other children at daycare. In other areas of development, Katie is at age level. So it's annual. We're looking at eligibility determination. We ask ourselves, can eligibility be established by records? And in this case, yes, they can. Based on those contact notes and the speech-language pathologist's ongoing assessment, we can still see that Katie is eligible for early intervention services. So that speech-language pathologist can complete the eligibility determination form. We don't need to bring anybody else in. We don't need to do anything else in terms of eligibility. With the assessment for service planning, again, let's assume there is enough information. It certainly appears that the speech-language pathologist has been doing a good job in terms of ongoing assessment and has information in all areas of development. So with that, we would not need any additional activity or people involved for the assessment for service planning. And we'd move on to the annual IFSP, where you would think that the team would be the family, the service coordinator, and the speech-language pathologist, since it appears that that is a separate person from the service coordinator. And then scenario number three, we have Cole. And I'll give you a minute. Why don't you read what information we have at the initial for Cole? Okay, so we'll take eligibility determination. We'll ask ourselves, can eligibility be established by records? And in this case, yes, because we have those written reports from CHKD documenting a 25% or greater delay in one or more areas of development. Okay, so the service coordinator completes the eligibility determination form. We move right to the assessment for service planning. And this is a situation where we do, in fact, have some written records that could potentially be used as part of assessment for service planning, since it says that those reports actually describe the skills that Cole's able to demonstrate in motor development as well as those that he's not yet using. So that is relevant in terms of the assessment for service planning, since it goes beyond that sort of reporting of level of delay. So then we would need the service coordinator and one other assessor, one other early intervention professional from another discipline within the local system to fill out that assessment for service planning team and step. Margaret Jones asks, in the initial report that we are getting from CHKD, were all areas assessed? And the information here does not say that all areas were assessed. So we're assuming that just gross and fine motor development were assessed. Okay, and then so we move on to IFSP for Cole, and we'll have the family, the service coordinator, plus probably the assessor who was involved from the local system. So Margaret, when she asked if the initial report were all areas assessed, she said, so then shouldn't the answer be no? And so I'm assuming, Margaret, that you're asking asking about the eligibility determination. And when I said, can eligibility be established by records, you're thinking the answer should have been no, because all areas were not assessed. But that's one of the great things about that question of can eligibility be established by records. If the answer is yes, if those records show that there's a 25% delay in at least one area, or there's atypical development, or there's a diagnosed condition, then those other eligibility determination requirements, like having to look at all areas of development, go right out the window. You just skip over that part of eligibility determination, right? Because you'll then be looking at all areas of development when you get to the assessment for service planning, and you'll be focusing on that child's strengths and needs in those areas, and on the three child indicator areas, their functional status. But as long as records establish the child is eligible, and you can answer yes, then that full eligibility determination process does not apply. Okay, why don't you take a minute and read what's happening with Cole as he comes to his annual IFSP. Okay, so here we have a situation where Cole hasn't been seen for a while as you're getting ready to come into the annual IFSP time. And so when we ask ourselves some of these questions, it's not quite as clear maybe. So the annual eligibility determination, can you establish eligibility by records? Well, you have some records and probably some ongoing assessment information, but that's 4 months old, right? So it's less than 6 months. The question is, does it sort of pass that test of, are you sure that what you were seeing 4 months ago is still representative of where Cole is right now? Especially maybe since he had been making some significant progress, you might be wondering, well, maybe if he's continued to make that progress, he might not be eligible anymore. Or because he hasn't, you know, his family's been focused on this family member with a serious illness, maybe has that progress leveled off? Has there been any regression? So, you know, it seems like a good chance you're going to want to look a little bit again when you're looking at eligibility in this kind of a situation. So if so, then you would need probably the PT and the OT who had been seeing him previously, you know, one or both to take a little bit of a look and have your actual multidisciplinary team make a determination about Cole's continuing eligibility. And the same thing with the assessment for service planning. And since those two kind of go hand in hand, if the PT and OT are taking a look for purposes of eligibility, then they can also be gathering some assessment information if it appears that Cole is still eligible. And then you'll have your annual IFSP if he is still eligible, with the service coordinator, the family, and the PT and or the OT participating. Okay, that brings us to the end of the information on eligibility assessment and IFSP. So we will take time for some more questions. I've tried to answer them as they came up in chat, but I want to make sure everybody has a chance. So if you give me just a second, I'm going to unmute everybody's lines.
The leader has unmuted your line.
Okay, so the way that we're going to do, and if you're able to keep your line muted with *6, if you're not talking, that'll help us sort of keep the noise level down so everybody can hear. But I'm essentially going to call on each local system to see if you've got a question or two, and I'll go, you know, sort of down the list or around the group and make sure everybody's got a chance to ask one or two questions, and then if we have enough time, we can go back around. I know some folks are all in one place, and some local systems maybe have folks gathered in more than one place. So when I call on your local system, we'll try to establish an opportunity for each of the locations to ask a question. So I'm just going to go down my list and start with Fairfax. Are there any questions from Fairfax? Okay. Either Fairfax has muted themselves or they don't have any questions. All right. How about Rappahannock area? Any questions from you all?
Not at the.
Okay. How about Rappahannock Rapidan? Okay. Loudoun? Alexandria. Are there any questions from Arlington?
Yeah, we have one question. It sounds like for IFSP meetings, both initial and annual, there's a requirement that the service coordinator, the family, and an early intervention provider be present.
There is a requirement that those folks participate. That
okay.
doesn't mean they have to be present.
Okay. So they could participate in writing.
Yes. Gotcha. Okay. Any other questions from Arlington?
No.
Okay. Oh, Prince Julia.
Wait, Kyla. It's Margaret.
Margaret?
Automatic eligibility.
Yeah, has there ever been consideration to giving torticollis an automatic eligibility? Because most of our babies, I mean, they're pretty much eligible.
I could take that back and double check. My recollection is I thought that that had been considered and the decision was not to, but I can double check about that.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that was any other questions here? I think that was it, Kyla.
Okay. How about Prince William? Any questions?
We do have one, Kyla.
Okay.
As part of the annual assessment, you were stating that we could use contact notes, progress notes, from the current providers to then create the IFSP, does that mean that we're no longer including age ranges?
No, the age ranges are still part of the annual IFSP.
Those age ranges.
Other questions from Prince William?
Kyla, one more. Saying we have to include the age ranges, so then we are continuing to use an assessment tool to come up with those age ranges as part of our annual assessment.
Those two do not necessarily go together. In order to have an age range, it doesn't mean you have to use a tool. And, or another way to think about that, doesn't mean you have to implement a tool according to a protocol or stop what you're doing. If you need a tool to kind of help make sure your thoughts about where that child would be in an age range are appropriate, kind of as a check and balance, you could certainly use your ongoing assessment information and pull out that tool and make some little marks and see if you're if you're right in thinking about where that child is in terms of an age range. You could also, as you're leading up to the annual, knowing that you're going to need that kind of information, you could, a provider could take a look at a tool prior to heading out for a visit. Think about what information she's already got from ongoing assessment and whether there are some pieces, some items on that tool where she's not so sure she knows where that child is, and incorporate those into the next visit so she is going ahead and gathering that information and has that complete picture so that she can, based on her ongoing assessment, make a statement about that child's age range.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, and how about Shenandoah?
I don't think we have any questions.
Okay.
Thank you, though.
Sure. Did I miss anybody? Or anybody that I already passed one, another chance?
How about Loudon?
Okay, Loudon.
I'm just going to ask the same one everybody's asked before, just to make sure. So for the annual, if you have the service coordinator and the interventionist wear two hats, so they're the interventionist and the service coordinator for the annual, and they have they need to I know if it's automatic, do they still need a second person to sign off on that, correct?
For the annual
for the annual IFSP, I'm sorry, the IFSP meeting, let me put it that way. Service coordinator and the interventionist are wearing two hats, same person.
Okay.
If a second person needs to participate, if they do it in writing, does that confirm that they have reviewed the information and they're signing the IFSP? Is that what that?
Yeah, that would mean that person's had an opportunity to review the information that's available at the IFSP and to weigh in on, outcomes and other kinds of things
right.
In writing, yes.
Okay. All right, so that would count for the writing part of it.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I'm going to remute the lines, and we'll talk about transition.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press #6.
Okay. So transition. We know that kind of the three big pieces of transition are the transition plan, the notification, and the transition conference. So we'll talk about each of those. But as we talk about the transition requirements and kind of figuring out how to implement and document those requirements, I think it's really important to remember that the purpose behind the federal and state requirements related to transition and the purpose behind the transition section of our IFSP really is to ensure that children and families receive the support they need for a smooth transition when they're leaving early intervention. And so that purpose can be kind of what anchors up, what we come back to when we're trying to figure out how to implement the requirements for transition in a particular situation. So as I said, there are those three kind of main federal requirements associated with transition. In terms of the transition plan, the table in Section 7 of our IFSP form, and we're going to look at that in a little bit, is the transition plan. And the federal requirements talk about, it has to include procedures to prepare the child for changes in service delivery or a new setting. It has to include discussions with and training of families about future placements and documentation that the notification was sent and that child-specific information was sent to Part B with parent consent. So there are certain pieces that need to be there. Our transition plan also addresses plans associated with that notification and that conference. That's also where we document that information. The notification, we know now, is a notification to local school division and the State Department of Education, and that notification is a referral for Part B services. And then we have the transition conference, which is intended to give the family more specific information about the services that their child can receive in the next program. And then just a final note about federal requirements. They do require that a meeting is held in order to develop the transition plan, and that there's a meeting to hold the transition conference. We are allowed to combine that into one meeting if you want. But whether you combine those or hold them separately, those meetings do have to meet the requirements for an IFSP meeting. So either the transition plan and transition conference are going to happen as part of an initial or annual IFSP, or they're going to happen as part of an IFSP review meeting. Either an IFSP review meeting that's already happening, or this is going to constitute. You're going to call an IFSP review meeting in order to develop the transition plan and or hold the transition conference. There are timelines associated with each of those three components of transition, and this diagram just kind of shows them on a timeline. All of them have to happen at least 90 days before the anticipated date of transition, and both the plan and the conference happen no more than 9 months ahead of that anticipated date of transition. In Virginia, usually that anticipated date of transition is going to be at age two, when the child's age eligible for school, for the start of the school year, or at age three. And so those timelines are kind of across the bottom as an illustration as well. Let's look at the transition section of the IFSP for a few minutes, which is where we do document a lot of what needs to happen related to transition. And this section of the IFSP really gives the service coordinator and the family some reminders about the kinds of things that need to happen or can happen as part of the transition process. So these are the top two boxes in that transition section, and this is information that you would generally be sharing at an initial IFSP meeting with the family. The first box gives just a general explanation about what transition means and some possible timing. The second box then gives some important transition dates for this specific child and family. And the purpose of that second box is just to give the family an idea about when transition might occur. There's no commitment associated with that second box. It doesn't matter whether the family's interested in going to Part B or how old the child is as they're entering the early intervention system. I think some folks have been a little confused about what that box means. And so when you're filling that out with the family, you're really just saying, listen, just to give you an idea, if you decide you're interested in preschool services through the school system, then in Virginia, your child would be age eligible at the start of the school year in, say, 2014, and we'd be notifying the local school system by April 1st of that year. Otherwise, if your child remains eligible for early intervention services, then he could continue to receive those services until his third birthday. And as your child gets older, we'll talk more about your specific plans and figure out exactly where in that window of time transition will actually happen. So that's what that second box is about. That second box includes a target date for notification and referral. The federal requirements tell us that that notification has to happen at least 90 days before the anticipated date of transition. In this case, in the second box, we're talking about 90 days before the start of the school year, in which the child is due by September 30th. We also, though, have a state interagency agreement with the Virginia Department of Education that speaks to timelines. And that says that the notification or referral has to happen by April 1st of that year, when the child will be due by September 30th. So unless you have a local agreement with a school system that has a different notification and referral deadline, the target date that you enter in that second box is going to generally be April 1st of the year that the child turns due by September 30th. The only really other exception to using April 1st would be if the child was referred to early intervention after April 1st of that year when they're going to be age eligible. And then the target date you put in is going to be, you know, a week or two in the future, giving yourself a chance to get that notification sent as quickly as possible. Okay. And then the transition plan. So the table below those two boxes that we've just looked at on the transition section of the IFSP is the transition plan. And we're going to be looking at the specific steps and activities on there when we look when we walk through some scenarios in a minute. But basically, that transition plan is for all children. It has to be developed 90 days and up to 9 months ahead of transition. The steps and the activities that you complete within that plan are going to depend on the family's specific transition plans and preferences. So you can use NA if an activity is not applicable, and we'll look at some examples of that. Or an activity might be applicable to that child and family, but the family chooses not to complete that activity or step, in which case you're going to write that in on the transition plan and document that family's choice. We talked before about the fact that there's a meeting to develop the transition plan, and I just want to be clear that at that meeting where you're first developing the transition plan, you don't have to fill in all of the steps at that first meeting. You're probably going to identify the first few activities that you're going to do, and then after that, the service coordinator and the family will continue to revisit that plan and take care of more steps and activities along the way, and then they'll update the rest of the IFSP team at IFSP review and annual IFSP meeting. Now, we talked about the fact that that different steps apply to different children and families, right? So one way to think about that is whether the child's potentially eligible for Part B or not. And if a child is potentially eligible for Part B, and that's most of the children in early intervention, really, then all of the steps in the transition plan potentially apply, or they do apply. A family may or may not be interested. If the child is not potentially eligible for Part B, then there are a couple of steps 2 and 4, that have to do with notification and the transition conference with Part B that would not apply to those children. And again, we'll look at that in some scenarios in just a minute. There's a lot of talk and I think sometimes some confusion about the anticipated date of transition. And so when you start planning transition with families, you're usually going to be working from one of two transition dates, either the start of the school year when the child's going to be 2 by September 30th or the child's third birthday. Now, I know there are still some local school systems who have rolling admissions of 2-year-olds, so you may be working with more kind of dates or possible dates, but usually either age 2 or age 3 are the most common. It's going to be important to document what the anticipated date of transition is. And you can do that in a contact note, or depending on how you complete your IFSPs, you may even want to document it on the transition page of the IFSP. If you're using the start of the school year, you may or may not know what that exact first day of school is. You know, with technology and the internet now, a lot of school systems where I am, you can see the calendar almost a year ahead, so you may be able to look it up and find the exact date. But if you can't, that's fine. You're just going to estimate. So if you know that school usually starts the last week of August, then pick a date that week. Document it. That's sort of the date you're working from in terms of an anticipated date of transition. And then you're also going to want to document, again, in a contact note or potentially on the IFSP, if the family changes their mind about when they're planning to transition. I know that folks worry about monitoring and record reviews and being out of compliance based on the required timelines for certain transition steps and the anticipated date of transition. And this is really one of those times where we're all going to remember our anchor, that the reason we have the requirements is to ensure support to children and families for a smooth transition. So we are less worried about whether it was 88 days ahead or 90 days ahead or 9 months and 1 day ahead than we are that you're working around a planned date and kind of working in the correct window for getting that planning done so that the child and family have a smooth transition. And when it comes to completing record reviews, I think people really particularly worry if a family has changed their mind and maybe they were originally planning to transition at the start of the school year when the child was two, and so you developed your transition plan and you did some things with that in mind, and now the family has decided to wait until their child is three. And so maybe the date when you developed that transition plan is now more than 9 months before that new transition date of age three. When you complete the record review form, you're the one filling it out, so you get to use the date that makes sense, right? If you planned most of those activities around the anticipated transition date for age two, then fill that in on the record review form. It's fine that the family later changed their mind. But even if you decided you wanted to use the most recent transition date in that example and use age three, or you just forgot that you had the option and you're using age three, even when it shows that that transition plan was developed more than 9 months ahead, it's okay because it was for a family reason. And so either way that you document that, you're still fine. Okay, transition conference then. Let's look just for a minute at the difference between a transition conference when the child's potentially eligible for Part B and the parent's interested in Part B versus a transition conference when the child's not potentially eligible or the parent's not interested in going to Part B. So the federal regulations tell us that if the child's potentially eligible for Part B, then a transition conference is required with the approval of the family. It has to happen 90 days or up to 9 months ahead. It involves the family, someone from Part C, and someone from Part B, has to at least be invited, and the purpose is to discuss services that the child may receive under Part B. If the child is not potentially eligible for Part B, the federal regulations say that we have to make a reasonable effort to hold a transition conference if the parent approves. They don't give any specific timelines for when that conference has to be held, but again, if we're all about making sure that things are in place in a timely manner to support that child and family making a transition, then it makes sense that the 90 days to 9 months is kind of the window that you'd be looking at, even if the child wasn't potentially eligible for Part B. And that it would involve the family, Part C, and providers of other appropriate services. And again, the purpose is to discuss the services that that child might receive in that other program. I do want to just note that if you're holding a transition conference for a child who is not potentially eligible for Part B, you are not going to document that in step four on the transition plan. So this is the transition section of our IFSP. That step number four is a transition planning conference that is specifically about going to Part B. And so if the child is not going to Part B and you're holding a transition conference, the child's not potentially eligible for Part B, you can document that in a number of other places. One would be under step one, community options. Step A talks about providing information about community options. Certainly one step in doing that could be holding that kind of a transition conference. You could document it in step three, support to enroll in other programs as an other step or activity. You could even document it in step five, transition services. 5B, help your child and family get ready to transition out. That could be a place to document a transition conference that you're holding for a child who's not going to Part B. About meetings, I mentioned earlier there are two kinds of meetings that happen as part of the transition. There's a meeting to develop the transition plan and a meeting for the transition conference. I also said that the federal regulations allow that those can be combined into one meeting. And so this slide just kind of helps you think about the differences between the two meetings, what's happening, what their purpose is, and those sorts of things, so that you can think about when it makes sense to combine them and when maybe it doesn't. To me, the meeting to develop the transition plan is going to be more comprehensive. You're going to be reviewing the steps and activities on the IFFP to give the families a complete picture of the kinds of support and activities that are available in the transition process. And you're going to be identifying at least the first few activities that you're going to be completing in the transition plan. The conference, on the other hand, is much more focused. It's about the services that the child can receive in the next program. So to me, and there's no right or wrong answer about this, but to me it makes sense to combine the two potentially for a family that's pretty sure they know what program they want to transition to, whereas for a family who really has no idea, they're really just starting to find out about options after early intervention, you might be better off with that family starting with a meeting to develop the transition plan, giving them the opportunity to do some of that exploring, and then maybe hold the transition conference a little later when they have a better idea about what their plans are. Okay, so let's look again at some scenarios. And we're going to revisit our friends Bobby, Katie, and Cole to do this. And with Bobby, his parents plan to have him transition to the local school system to start preschool special ed services at the start of the school year after he turns two in June. So let's take a look at what we might do as we're filling out a transition plan for Bobby. So step one with those community options, you know, even though Bobby's parents are sure or pretty sure they want him to go to Part B, they still may be interested in getting some information about other programs in their community. So this certainly could apply to them. You know, in step A, you're providing information, potentially arranging visits in B, and then C is other. And we talked about the fact that you could document a transition conference there if you're holding a conference other than for Part B. And sometimes people ask for other examples of what could be in Step 1C. In addition to the example that's given there, you might have a family who's interested in some help to make a comparison across programs on certain factors. That might be something you're helping them with. Or they're interested in getting accreditation information about some of the programs that they're looking at. So any of those kind of other pieces of information that you might be helping with could be documented there in 1C. Step two is the notification and referral, and certainly Bobby, with his diagnosed visual disability, is potentially eligible for Part B, so step two applies to him. So in step 2A, you're going to be entering the earliest date on which notification would be sent so that it goes by April 1st. And we know these parents want that referral, so they're not going to opt out. You're going to go ahead and send that notification and then enter the date in step 2B to show the date it was sent to the local school division and the date you entered the information in the database for the Virginia Department of Education. And then in step 2C, presumably Bobby's parents are going to consent to the release of information, and you'll document the date that they gave that consent and the date the information was sent. Step three, similar to step number one, even though Bobby's parents want him to go to Part B, they still may be interested in some support to enroll in another program. We'll look at that step a little more carefully with another one of our scenarios. Step number four is the transition planning conference. Again, since Bobby's potentially eligible for Part B, this step does apply. You have to provide parental prior notice and document that date here, and then you'll document whether or not the parents approve. And we're going to assume that Bobby's did approve the conference since they're interested in that referral. And then you would complete the information in 4C about when it was held and who participated. Now, if Bobby's parents for some reason already knew a lot about Part B, maybe he had an older sibling that had participated, and they said no, that they did not approve the transition conference, then step 4C would be NA, not applicable. That would be one of those situations where you would use that, and you would note it right here on the form. Step five, transition services. This is another one where we get some questions sometimes about what would be in step 5B. What are some examples? You might be facilitating a classroom visit, assisting the family with school paperwork. This is also the place to note that you might be working on some specific child outcomes that will help the child adjust to the new setting. So if there are steps at the school, and there are no steps at home, that might be something new that you're working on. Things like communicating wants and needs and social skills obviously become very important if you're looking at transitioning, particularly maybe into a group setting for the first time. You might be looking to expand the location of services to assist the child in getting ready, again, maybe to be in a group setting or to ride a bus, for instance, or helping the family figure out transportation to the new program if that's not something the program provides. So those are the kinds of things that you might see in step 5B. And then step six is just exiting early intervention documentation associated with that discharge process. Okay, Let's take a look at Katie, and I'll give you just a minute, and why don't you read about Katie's situation? Okay, so I'm not going to walk through the details of every step with each of these that we've already, since we've already done some of that. But so Katie, even though, her mom has said that she wants to just stay with the daycare, so community options, it doesn't mean that that one's not applicable, right, because community options could be appropriate or something that this family would be interested in. So if Katie's mom says, no, I'm not really interested in exploring other community options, I'm sticking with daycare, then instead of writing NA in step one, you're going to note that that the family's not interested in other programs. They're going to continue using their existing daycare services, for example. And then step number two, we know that her mom is not interested in going to the school system. So why don't you guys weigh in on chat and tell me whether or not you think you have to fill out anything in step number two for Katie, since her parents don't want a referral. We got people weighing in. Got yes, you still need to fill something in. You need to write that the parent declined. Yeah, that's all right on target. Even though Katie's family's not interested, Katie is potentially eligible for Part B because she hasn't caught up in all areas. So you do need to address step number two. Again, you're going to fill in that date by which it was going to be sent, and then the family would initial in that first bullet under step 2A to say they're opting out and they don't want that information sent. And so in that situation, then step 2B, the date the notification and referral was sent, would be NA, not applicable, and step 2C would be not applicable as well. Step three, again, similar to step one, if the family is not interested in enrolling in other programs, and it doesn't sound like they are in this case, you're going to note that here in step number three. Step number four, transition planning conference, just like step number two, they're not interested, but the step still applies because Katie is potentially eligible for Part B. So you will need to provide the parental prior notice and document that date here. And then you're going to mark that the family did not approve the transition conference. And step 4C would be not applicable. And step 5 and 6 are the same as they would be when we looked at Bobby. And then finally, we have Cole, who at 18 months old, Cole's parents and his providers feel that he's caught up. Cole's parents don't want another eligibility determination and feel that he's ready to leave early intervention. Okay, so let's look here for Cole. The first point I want to make is that even though Cole is leaving ahead of age 2 or 3 and has caught up, the transition plan, you still offer transition planning to Cole's families. They may or may not be interested, but there are still steps within here that are potentially applicable. They may be interested in knowing about some other community options for children Cole's age. They may be wanting some support to enroll in those other programs, and even step number 5, transition services, they may be interested in, some checklists for upcoming age levels that might help them keep an eye on Cole's development, or some information about activities that are good to do with children his age and at upcoming ages. So some of those steps may still apply if Cole's family is interested. The two that definitely do not are step 4, the transition planning conference, and step 2, the notification and referral to the local school division, because Cole is not potentially eligible for Part B. And perfect timing, I see Rapidan is asking, where are we documenting when and who decides a child is not potentially eligible for Part C? And that can be documented in a contact note. And that is an IFSP team decision. Remember, unless the child is caught up and is no longer eligible for Part C, that child is potentially eligible for Part B. Right, potentially eligible for Part B, yes. Okay, so that brings us to the end of our transition section. So I'm going to open the phone lines again and see if we have any other questions or discussion around transition.
The leader has unmuted your line.
Okay, so let's check in and see. I'm going to go in reverse order this time and see. Shenandoah, do you all have any questions related to transition?
We don't. You.
Okay. How about Prince William?
We do have a question, Kyla. For the transition pages, at the top of each numbered section, must a date go in there understanding that NA can be used for A, B, or C under, like, Section 1, Section 2, but do we need a date for the whole section, for target date and date completed?
Yeah, if some part of that step is being addressed, then you'll complete a target date and a date completed. If the entire step is not applicable, or the family has said that they're not interested, then you would not need a date. And you could either put an NA in those spots so you know you've sort of filled them in, or you could, I guess you could leave them blank as long as you have it well documented in that first column that it was NA or the family was not interested.
Thank you. And I also have a question. You had just addressed this about the parental prior notice. When a family isn't interested in the transition conference, and I really got lost there. Would you mind going over that again?
Not at all. So if the child is potentially eligible for Part B, then the federal regulations require a transition conference with the approval of the family. So we need to give parental prior notice to the family of any child who's potentially eligible for Part B that a transition conference is needed. And we would document in Step 4A the date on which you provided that parental prior notice. So if the family then says, no, they're not interested, then in Step 4B, that's where you're going to say, we gave them notice, but they said, no, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions in Prince William?
No, thanks, Kyla.
Okay. How about Arlington? Okay. How about Alexandria?
Questions.
Okay. I heard somebody say. Okay. How about Loudon?
Kyla?
Yes.
Hi, this is Margaret. I think we were muted and didn't know it. We do have a question. It's from Barbara.
Okay.
Hi. Just asking, do we still fill out this transition plan if a kiddo is getting discharged and they're a baby, let's say they're like 12 months old? Do we still have to figure out sections 1 and 3?
You need to ask the family about it, yeah. And if the family's not interested, then that's all you're going to need to be noting. But you do need
okay.
to offer transition planning to those families, yes.
And so we still have to do a parental prior notice saying that we're doing a transition plan for little ones who are exiting.
Yep, and a family can tell you no thank you, but yes.
Okay, no thank you to the transition plan or the transition conference. I think that's our question.
Either one.
A 12-month-old gets offered a transition conference where a Part B individual is invited?
A 12-month-old who's leaving because they've caught up would not be offered a transition conference because that child's not potentially eligible for Part B.
Okay.
Other questions from Arlington?
No. There's no more questions at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Then let me go back and double check with Loudon. Any questions there?
Oh, I think I'm on mute. Am I on mute?
No, we can hear you.
Okay, I don't have any questions. Sorry about that. I keep pushing lots of sixes.
Okay, how about Nick Rapidan?
Okay, I don't hear anything from them. How about Rappahannock area? And then finally, Fairfax.
Kyla, we don't have any questions.
Okay.
Kyla, it's
well, then
Jenny.
That brings us to the end, unless anybody has another question that they've thought of.
Kyla, can you hear me? It's
yes.
Jenny. We have one more question.
Okay.
Kyla, we have a question about Section 2B. Here in Prince William, we have an arrangement with the school system to put I'll give you a date example of 2/17. Let's say we had our transition meeting on February 17th. If we send everything over and do the referral that day, they would like us to do 2/17 for 4/1 referral for April 1st. Is that okay? This is an informal arrangement we have with them, but is that okay for Part C?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. If you've worked out a time other than April 1st for your local school system or a date by which your notification needs to be sent ahead of April 1st. Yeah, that's perfectly fine.
Well, they don't process them until April 1st. So if we have our referral that we send over on a certain date, we document on our end that we've sent it over on that date, but they don't actually do anything until April 1st with it. Is that acceptable?
Yeah, because it works on our end. I'm not sure how they get away with it on their end, but it's fine for us.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then thank you all for participating today. If you think of other questions, please feel free to get them to Terry, and I'll make sure to get answers to everybody. So, thank you again, and everybody have a good day. Bye-bye.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now...